Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I am Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with the internationally renowned and much awarded Professor K.K. Agarwal. Professor Agarwal, you bring to this interview a substantive history of significant and considerable national and international contribution to research, engineering, computing science, executive leadership, education, society, and industry. We are indeed fortunate to have you share your many deep experiences with the audience. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. It's my pleasure to be able to talk to you and to reach a large target audience. Thank you again.
Now, Krishan, can you discuss your past and recent top roles and significant contributions?
Yeah, I was fortunate in more than one way. For example, I think I had a very large share of getting assignments which enabled me to create the things rather than maintain the things. For example, when I was head of the department, I was given the responsibility to start the Department of Electronics and Communication Engineering, then the Department of Computer Science, then the first Technical University of Northern India, and finally the much-awaited Professional University in Delhi. So that gave me a lot of opportunity whereby I could translate the things into practice. In addition to that, I concurrently held positions like president of IETE, CSI, etc. And again, I was probably one of the youngest presidents in the country. I was probably youngest professor all over. So to be able to establish and lead a university at the age of 50 is still a little uncommon. So that gave me enough exposure and opportunity to do this.
You know, I invite the audience to have a closer look at your profile, which is published with the interview. It's just a remarkable history of significant contribution in so many areas and really just a fascinating history. Now, Krishan, how do you balance demanding concurrent assignments with your leadership roles?
Yeah, I mean, difficult to answer as such, but I think the two attributes which I have developed over the period of time, one I think is time management, which I feel that in a position like this, and particularly concurrent assignments, you have to manage your time. And secondly, I feel you have to get into the habit of anticipate what will be required to be done by you in the next few weeks, next few months, and plan well in advance when you have the time, even much before the issue really arises. Secondly, I also feel that the concurrent assignments also give you an opportunity to synergize the experience of one functionality in other domains. And if you keep your eyes open to that, many a times it rather helps to be having concurrent assignments. Basic key, I would feel, would be that a person should be able to use the available time slots depending upon the priority and not a fixed programming, but sort of a dynamic programming, much like changing the TV channels, that we could start thinking all over afresh.
Wow, that's just amazing. Now, I should tell the audience that this is an international conversation occurring literally over 10,000 kilometers away, and we are getting some interference in the communication line, so just bear with us, and hopefully it'll clear up as we continue this conversation. So, again, to the audience, it's not your current recording device or listening device. It's just part of the communication channels we're using right now. So, Krishan, you are the recipient of so many honors for your continuing historical impact in many, many fields. Which ones stand out and why?
Again, a difficult question, but I think I would partition into various time spans. As a student, best is for your academics, and I was fortunate to have the first position in the university in all the three exams before entering the college, after leaving the college, and after the final exam in the university. Thereafter, when I was really active on to research, It was a great opportunity for, say, for example, IEEE Transactions and Reliability to invite me to guest edit one of their transactions. To the best of my recapitulation, I would feel that it's a rare opportunity that somebody from another country was given the opportunity to edit that, particularly from India. I mean, many Indians might have done it who are in USA, but an Indian settled in India to be asked to guest edit US edition of IEEE transactions. And then they gave me a guest editor award, which I thought was a great motivation for me in my further research work. And then I also feel that the professional societies, which are sort of characterized by your peers, once they recognize you, you feel motivated. For example, my own country, IETE, Institution of Electronics and Telecom Engineers, made me president, gave me distinguished fellowship. Computer Society of India gave me fellowship. Broadcasting Society of India made me honorary fellow, so on and so forth. So those things also make you feel that your peers sort of recognize you. And finally, the social recognition by bibliographical institutes like American Bibliographical Institute or International Bibliographical Institute of Cambridge. When they place you in the first few in the world, you feel that you are probably doing something relevant to the society, and that keeps you going. So I feel the people have been good to me to honor me with these awards. And I'll take this opportunity to thank all of them.
Well, again, just a considerable history of remarkable success. So from that success, what pivotal lessons do you wish to share?
Stephen, I would feel that with my limited experience as a student of information technology as such, the few lessons which I thought can be useful, particularly to the younger generation, number one, I would say be open to the new ideas always. I mean, I find that most of the people do not wish to try new ideas, and that probably is a great damage to the progress which is in the offing. I still remember one of the directors of the colleges when I was the vice chancellor of the university said, "Sir, then whenever we come with a new idea, you always encourage us to go ahead." I said, "If the idea is worth it, then only you will be able to develop it further. Why should we stop it before you even attempt to develop it?" So that's the first thing which I would feel. Second thing which I would feel, particularly for developing countries and to some extent even in the developed countries now, I mean, I feel very bad when people use the excuse that this could have been done, but resources is a limitation. I feel resources for any good project can always be managed, maybe with some difficulty all over the world. And if one has a nice idea or a project, he or she should also have the capability to manage the resources, which I feel has been possible. And thirdly, I feel one has to ensure that your positive attitude is recognized by the people who have to approve your proposals. Once again, it's no good seeing that I had a wonderful idea, but my bosses could not appreciate it or my superiors could not appreciate it. I feel it's your responsibility as an originator of the idea to also be able to market it to the concerned people, because then only you are able to carry it forward.
Very, very great lessons to pass on to the audience. Now, in your prior roles, what were the most difficult challenges that you were not able to overcome at the time, and what would you do differently now?
Stephen, I don't think this is a very digital question in the sense that there could be very sort of defined answer to this. But nonetheless, I feel a few things which I would like to share with the audience here. Number one is, we have a formal education system. We have non-formal education system all over the world. There have been some attempts, but I still feel all over the world and to a great extent in developing countries, convergence or migration from formal system to non-formal system and vice versa is rather very much restricted. I would feel the opportunities will be vast open to a large cross-section if we could make this migration a little easier, where people could do a part of the course in a formal system, another part on a non-formal system. Second, and for what I could have done differently is probably to create more awareness that this is the requirement, and once more people are aware, probably it would have been easy. Second thing which I feel is, although we have done, particularly in developing countries, I'm saying, the academic regulations are still not as flexible as they should have been. I've tried my best, many of my friends have tried, but still we feel that the needed flexibility in the knowledge world today has to be much, much more than the compartmentalization in education framework, which still exists to a good extent. What would I have done differently in this is I feel me and people like me have to very strongly remember that everybody who listens to you is not a willing change agent. So if we want the change, we will have to make them willing to the proposal. And thirdly, I feel being a part of the professional education, that again more relevant to the developing countries, we have to do much more to bring industry to the universities. We have been rather feeling that this will happen automatically. To some extent, there have been great success stories, but probably the synergy between the professional actual world and the academic world has to pick up much more. I mean, as a matter of fact, I feel the best example is the medical education which we have. Probably that has to go on in architectural education, in management education, in engineering education, in IT education on a similar scale. That's what I think.
So what were then the key disruptive forces driving change in your life, and how can we learn from your experiences?
I would feel disruptive forces probably can be listed as, first I could say that I'll have to accept that conservatism is a reality. To believe that people will accept the change as it is not that easy. Born conservatism, and unfortunately, I find many a times the conservatism in the academic world is more than the professional world, because the question of survival becomes much more relevant in professional world, and therefore sometimes universities are not that fast in changing as they should have been. Second observation which I feel is whenever we sort of attempt a change, all are not competent. And for a person who is not very competent, status quo appears to be the safe haven. So they would feel that if status quo remains, they are safe, so why should they allow you to change? Again, I feel we'll probably have to work that, tell those people by some brainstorming sessions or something, that if we change, probably we go from a safe haven to a better heaven. Then probably they may accept. And thirdly, again, sometimes in a hierarchical system, your superiors are not appreciative of the change, and therefore something which you want to introduce do not get introduced because you don't get necessary sanctions for that. So learning from experience again is that you have to market your proposals much better for you to succeed.
Now, again, sort of mining all of your experience and breadth of knowledge, can you comment on regional and global academic and professional growth?
As far as academic and professional growth is concerned, all over the world it is happening. And when we say regional, I think I can sort of talk about India or Southeast Asia region. The growth is happening here also. I think all over it has been now well recognized that technology, academics, and professional growth is a sort of a question of not a desirability, but survivability of any nation. And therefore, all over the world, including in this region, the growth is happening. People have realized that this growth is a must, and various models are being evolved to expedite this growth to the extent possible. I feel as far as growth pattern is concerned, we are on the right track.
Now, Krishan, what is the role of professional societies and why should professionals get involved?
Yeah, I've been asked this question many a times, particularly when I was president of Electronics and Telecom Engineers or president of Computer Society of India or president of SIARC. My answers have been, and which I repeat here, role of professional societies in associating themselves is really great. And first and foremost, I feel, is a feeling of fraternity. Let the youth or the incoming people to the profession do feel that the association with their senior colleagues, with the people who have had an experience, they have a formal platform for that, where they can share that experience. That itself, according to me, is a great thing. And particularly, this experience in professional societies is available at very affordable cost, if I may use the word. You just have to walk to them to gain from their experience, which can happen in professional societies, not in a competitive world otherwise. So this bonding between various generations, I mean, at least three generations are easily seen in a membership of a professional society, that bonding becoming stronger, so you sort of have the advantage of experience and the new ideas come together on one platform, and I've seen many a times this giving great dividends. And I feel this should be further encouraged.
Well, you very much are a role model of, you know, being involved with professional societies, but also of leadership because of your leadership with universities and founding them, and then you know, as you and then being president of so many different major associations. Really, a remarkable history. What role do you see IFIP, the International Federation for Information Processing, and IP3, which is the International Professional Practice Partnership Program, playing regionally and globally?
As far as this question is concerned, as far as IFIP is concerned, I mean, IT is a tool which is now changing the world. It's pervasive so much that the entire world, all countries, whether developed or developing, all age groups, all demographic profiles are affected by IT. And IFIP is the largest society in this subject of information technology, having so many countries as their members. So whatever earlier I have talked about the role of professional societies applies to IFIP also at the international level. And I certainly feel institutions like IFIP can have a great role to play. As far as IP3 is concerned, let's appreciate the fact that IT as a subject is a little more oriented towards skills rather than bookish knowledge. And to that extent, this subject differs from many subjects. Say, for example, if one has to distinguish between, say, physics and IT or mathematics and IT, IT takes you much more on the skills front in addition to the knowledge than the other conventional subjects. And whenever it comes to skills, the testing of skills up to a level, certification of those skills with a global benchmark is not very easy. IP3 has certainly taken a lead in the world to establish benchmarks for skill certification, for professional competence certification. And in a subject like IT, I think, and where the mobility all over the world is very high of IT professionals, as an individual, really see IP3 playing a great role in the coming years. At the moment, it appears to be a little slow, but as always for a new concept. But as an individual, I am convinced we have a great need of acceptable certification of skills, and IP3 is the body which will certainly be able to be seen doing a great role in the coming decades.
Now, can you profile educational innovations in developing countries and how we can all learn from this experience?
Yeah, when I see the developing countries' educational innovations, I find a few things which are positive according to me, and will help everybody. First is a public-private partnership has been accepted as a successful model all over the world. I mean, there were situations where people were very skeptical about it, but now in almost all developing countries, this model is being tried. Although there are glitches in seen in this implementation of this model at times, but that's okay according to me. I mean, you should think of removing the glitches rather than not having the model. So this model is successful and will have to be encouraged further. Second innovation which I find in education in developing countries is the cost effectiveness is shaping up. I was witness to the fact that even in developing countries, the resources were not being optimally utilized. And in one of my lectures, I had described this dichotomy at great length, that on one hand, the country is developing, so they are short of resources. On the other hand, the resource optimization is just not being thought of, and a lot of resources are being wasted. But now cost effectiveness is shaping up in education world, and that I think is a positive sign. The third thing which I feel I could share with your audience is synergy between education and training is becoming a reality. There was a time when we sort of have two compartments, that this is what we call as knowledge advancement, or this takes you to an upper platform of knowledge, and therefore this is a worthwhile education. But if something takes you to a better level of skill, that was not seen with that degree of respect, and we dismiss it as vocationalization or training component and things like that. I think that distinction is becoming fuzzy, and I feel that's again a good, positive thing happening in the world, and we have to carry it forward.
You know, Krishan, your last comment then sort of leads to this next question, and that's about explaining the convergence between education and training.
Yeah, as I said, Stephen, see, education, I mean, this may not be a worldwide view, but that's what happened was we always believed that you are eligible to get a degree if you are able to contribute to the advancement of knowledge in the real sense. But if you are not really advancing the knowledge, but you are applying it, or you are doing something by hand to make a tool out of it or make an instrument out of it, that was not seen that much degree of respect. And as a matter of fact, when I was the vice chancellor, a very interesting case come to my knowledge. You know, in India, we have medical education in 2 tiers. We have a 5 year or 4.5 year as the first degree, and then 3 years as the second degree, unlike many other countries. And I was very surprised when we had the first degree classified as education and the second degree classified as training. And thereby bringing in compartmentalization, that if you're a trainer, you cannot be an educator and vice versa. I mean, it just didn't appeal to me at all, and I changed the total scene. I said, nothing doing. This will have to be accepted as one area. Second thing I feel again is, you know, hands-on, the courses which require more hands-on work were probably given less credit weightage than the courses which require more brain hours. When we have the world of today, which is technology-driven and now IT-driven maybe, we have to make sure that the student or anybody in an education system, the effort put in terms of brain hours or in terms of hand hours, I still may call it, there has to be some correlation, because particularly in a level like this, you can't use your hands without the brains. It's only the degree of involvement which could be different. And third point, which I again sort of has a similarity, is that the vocational courses, which typically went up to what we call as polytechnics or diploma levels, or training trade institutions, etc., etc. I think these courses themselves have to be given a degree of respect and they should also lead you to the equivalent degrees, which effort is now being made. And I, for one, believe that the differences or the demarcations between education and training in the conventional sense have to go if we really have to see that a subject like technology or IT really proves to a very large cross-section of the society.
Well, you definitely are an innovator and thought leader, and I really much respect the ideas you're putting forward and that you've been supporting throughout your career. So just remarkable again. Now, that kind of leads to this next question, and that can you explain then the convergence between formal and non-formal education?
See, particularly in developing countries, we had a system, you know, either by and large you are through the formal system, that is, you get enrolled in a university and you are there in the university till you get the degree and then you come out, and by and large the parents will support your education. Only those who could not afford to go to a university, primarily because of financial considerations, were sort of opting for non-formal education, where they can sit at home, study themselves, and appear in the exam at a very affordable cost. Now, this may be all right by itself, but the point is that if you can have a mix of the two, which we now call as blended learning or a combination of all these things, is this something which is greatly required in the world? If I talk about India, for example, see, we still have gross enrollment ratios of the order of 12%, which we aim to take it to 25% by 2030, which itself means we need about 15,000 universities more, as against less than 1,000 at the moment, if we restrict ourselves to formal education system. Now, formal education system, therefore, stand alone, will continue to deprive many, particularly those who cannot afford it financially. But if we have a good convergence, good credit transfer, good migration, one may have a possibility of converting a four-year program to 1+3 or 2+2 or 3+1, then maybe one can have better of both worlds. And coupled with this is the fact that I again know by my experience all over the world, and particularly in developing countries, we have acute shortage of good teaching faculty. Now, once you have a non-formal education system supporting you, then there's a great possibility of taking lessons from the best of the teacher in the world at an affordable cost, and which is being helped by domestic tutors or tutors in other countries. So that model where one eminent professor can reach a very large cross-section is possible in a non-formal education, particularly ICT-enabled education, and I feel strongly that the need for that has come in the world.
Well, you definitely have a very inclusive approach to education, and that's just, again, it's a remarkable insight. Krishan, you have this very long history of considerable international success, just many, many, many accomplishments, and so in that way, I think you're perfectly placed to kind of look into your crystal ball and sort of predict where things are going. So, I know this is difficult. So, can you provide your predictions of future trends and their implications and opportunities?
Well, as you said, it's future trends in a subject like this is very difficult. But I'm just thinking a few concepts rather than very brass tacks trends. Firstly, I believe that the convergence of knowledge is going to become a reality, and we should facilitate it as soon as possible. Even talking about sciences, we have seen for several decades that either you are on to medical sciences or you are on to, say, engineering sciences or applied sciences. Now, this kind of division has at times done more damage to the knowledge than really creating the kinds of applications which the world was looking forward to. So this distinction between subjects probably will be narrow, and I personally feel should be narrower. Even between arts and sciences, one has to kill this difference and carry it forward. And what we say now, one particular convergence which I see happening, which has already started but probably has to take on very long way, is a sort of convergence of info, bio, nano, as we say. Information technology, biotechnology, and nanotechnology. They will all have to converge to lead to meaningful applications. I know some very well-established scientific experiments are being done, say in the United States, for Genelia forms is one example, where people of all disciplines are working together at the moment just to find out how the brain of a fruit fly works. So these kinds of things will have to go further. Second thing which I feel is we will, as information technologists, we have told the world that the networking has been very helpful. I think we will have to extend this concept to collaborative working between head, hands, and heart. One will have to see that all these three organs are working for meaningful applications. You have to have knowledge applied, you have to have skills applied, and you have to have the feel of the society around you to lead to meaningful applications. And third thing which I feel is without a strong sense of economics, the technologies fail. We as technologists will always have to keep an open mind on economics. Something will succeed in this world only and only if it leads to economic growth in addition to anything else. So the technologists will have to be very economic savvy and vice versa. And lastly, I would feel, I'll take the liberty to say that information technologies, pervasive power will continue to increase, and therefore more and more applications is the domain of the younger generation particularly. I've been saying this is probably for the first time in the entire history of civilization where technology is there, applications have to follow. Otherwise, we always thought of the need of an application and then the technology. So we now have to see that how to make use of these powerful things for things which we do not think feasible today. And that training has to go into all of our younger generation, and then probably we'll be able to do much better.
So what are your top recommended resources for computing professionals and why?
For computing professionals, I see the way the things are going on, I see a total change. Maybe all of us would be working in a different environment within this decade maybe. I personally feel we'll all have to get accustomed to cloud computing much more, where the entire philosophy of computing will change. I won't have to pay for infrastructure which I don't use. I don't have to pay for memory which I don't use. I don't have to pay for software which I don't use. And therefore, the net cost effectiveness will be very, very high, and that will lead to tremendous amount of applications at the hands of everybody, and I see a great many things happening when the total environment shifts.
Now, throughout your travels, you've encountered many interesting events, perhaps something surprising or unexpected or humorous.
Yeah.
Can you share maybe one or more stories from your work?
I'll try one or two. First thing which comes to my mind is when I was a student for my PhD degree on research, and I was working on reliability evaluation and optimization. I still recollect very exactly the scene. One day I was working after dinner on my research, and a heuristic method for optimization and reliability came to my mind. And I just figured it out, and probably by the morning I was ready with the research paper, which could be sent to IEEE transactions on reliability. I did send that. And when I was writing my thesis, doctoral thesis, I was feeling this is such a simple, trivial thing. Do I include it in my thesis at all when I have many other things to say? Is it really worthwhile to include? It is such a simple technique. But nonetheless, I included it. But what really gave me the satisfaction is that paper of mine not only was published in IEEE Transactions on Reliability, but was continued to be cited for 25 years without break. You know, the lesson which I learned from this is that a simple thing could be a very important concept. By and large, my research papers all have been written in very simple language, but this gave me a further, I think, that something which you can write in a very simple language, which you can state in a very simple language, which persons from other disciplines can understand, then probably you are making a large impact which motivates you further and helps the society more. The second incident which I could share with you was a sort of a professional step. I was in USA to deliver some lectures, and after a lecture in Jet Propulsion Lab, Pasadena, right at the moment, I was asked that would I be willing to join JPL, Jet Propulsion Lab. It was 1982, and I just said that what would be my salary, and the person just asked me a question: what's your age? I didn't understand really what's the relationship between age and package. But then he said, you are 34. So any engineer in the length and breadth of USA, 34 years old, have his salary known and add $5,000 to it, that will be your salary. Now, that's the kind of motivation which my work would get for me. Another small story which I could share with the audience is I was giving lectures in industry on a full-day basis. I used to lecture almost 8 hours a day non-stop for 2 days, 3 days to industry, because senior industrialists will not be able to spare many days. I was invited by a company called TVS Electronics in Chennai in India to give lectures, and my managing director was on the line. He said, what is the sort of compensation you expect? I said, who will be attending my lecture? He said, I myself will attend the lecture for all 3 days. I said, if you make sure that you attend all 24 hours, I'll charge nothing, because that makes me believe that my work is being appreciated by you, and that's probably the great satisfaction for a scientist like me. So,
again, I just love those stories that you've shared. Now, you know, we've asked a series of questions, but I know I've missed key questions, so I'm going to turn the tables and say, well, what questions would you have asked, and then what would be your answers?
Oh, a difficult role you have given me. But let me think. You know, the first question which I would have asked my guest would be probably, there are conflicting views on whether information technology is a facilitating digital divide or is it enabling level playing field for by and large all citizens. What's your take and why? My answer to this would be that I, for one, believe that information technology was charged with digital division because we really could not go to that level of applications which affect the common man. If we do that, then it's a great leveler, and I remember a speaker who very humorously put it, IT stands for income tax and IT stands for information technology. And both do not spare anybody. So if you could really use it the way it should be used as a tool, it could impact everybody. And therefore, I personally would believe that this makes a digital bridge rather than a digital divide. My second question could be, you seem to live with ICT all the time. Are there any lessons for the society which may not be necessarily technological? Well, if I think about it, any technology becomes long-lasting if it takes the society along in a natural way. The technology should be able to impact the society and society technology in a very synergistic fashion. Some of the lessons which I feel the information technology can tell to everybody in the world, irrespective of the subject, are as follows. First of all, first time right. this technology has told us you have no time to make mistakes. You have to be right for the first time. This technology has told us that sharing does not make you poorer. You share the information and you still have it. This technology helps us learn to believe each other, because the great concept of networking, that this technology again makes you understand that very strict discipline and great flexibility can coexist. I always give the example of internet. It has no owner, it has no master, it's a completely free system, but still it has a very strong protocol, and a single mistake does not allow you to assess it. So I always use it as a teacher to say that do not tell me that the discipline and freedom cannot coexist. I think this technology does tell us that. The third question, Stephen, which I would attempt is, there has always been some resistance in IT applications, particularly in developing countries. Why and how will you handle it? There has been resistance in using information technology in several applications, particularly when people felt that this will be a technology which will sort of reduce the employment opportunities, reduce the requirements, and people will become more unemployed and things like that. I again personally feel, and history has proved it now, that this is the wrong myth which had been spread in developing countries to begin with. This technology has only changed the profile of jobs, profile of work, and it has created much more employment than it was feared that it may lose. Today's statistic is that for one job in information technology, there are four jobs which are automatically getting created in fields other than information technology. That factor was probably overseen in the earlier years. Now, having come to realize that, I think this technology will be accepted by more people with more open mind, and that, I think, is a great potential for change.
Well, I very much thank you for giving us those insights, and you are so elegant in your explanations and sharing your stories and your insight and your experiences. And
nice to hear it from a person of your level.
You know, Professor Krishan Agarwal, you know, we will continue to follow your significant global and historical contributions, and I know your schedule is very busy, and we thank you for taking the time to share your wisdom and accumulated insights with the audience.
Thank you very much, Stephen. My pleasure, and I'll always be available.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Professor Krishan Agarwal, who brought to this interview a substantive history of significant and considerable national and international contribution to research, engineering, computer science, executive leadership, education, society, and industry.